This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
Today, we're talking about the white evangelical church and the presidential election.
I support Donald Trump. I voted for him, and I will vote for him. He's a brave man. He's honest. He's trying to do the best he can, and I believe in Christian values.
And thanks for that message. Now, Donald Trump isn't everyone's idea of a religious man, but that hasn't stopped him from appealing to his Christian base.
What the hell was Biden thinking when he declared Easter Sunday to be Trans Visibility Day? Such total disrespect to Christians, and November 5th is going to be called something else. You know what it's going to be called? Christian Visibility Day, when Christians turn out in numbers that nobody has ever seen before.
That was Trump speaking at a rally in Wisconsin last Tuesday. We should note that Biden did not start Trans Day of Visibility. A trans activist started it in 2009. The Trump strategy to win Christian support is working for some. Roughly 8 out of 10 white evangelicals supported Trump in the 2016 general election. A February Pew Research survey found that among religious groups, white evangelicals had the most positive opinion of Trump, more than any other religious group polled. But despite their outsized political power, the white evangelical church is shrinking. According to the Public Religion Research Institute, about 14% of the population identifies as white evangelical. That's compared to 25% in the 1990s. Coming up after the break, we explore how decades of political organizing by white evangelicals culminated in Trump's presidency. What does it all mean for the election this fall? I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. We've got a lot to get to. Stay with us.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, the automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy explains how Betterment's technology helps investors better understand and save on taxes.
So taxes are a real cost of investing, as are fees. Understanding your after-tax, after-fee returns is really what's important for investors. An example would be when you buy and sell securities frequently, you can pay a lot of taxes because short-term capital gains, meaning I bought it and I sold it fairly quickly, have higher taxes than long-term capital gains. Our technology in particular will tell you what the tax implication of a particular move you'd like to make is going to be before you make that move so that you're making it with full transparency.
Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed.
Joining us from Norfolk, Virginia is NPR political correspondent Sarah McCammon. Her new book is called The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Sarah, it's always great to have you.
Hey, Jen. Great to be here.
Also with us from Minneapolis, Minnesota is Angela Danker. She's a journalist and Lutheran pastor. She's also the author of several books, including Red State Christians. Her forthcoming book is called Disciples of White Jesus, The Radicalization of American Boyhood. Angela, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also here with 1A's Todd Zwillick. And we just want to note, you may hear several different terms throughout this conversation referring to a kind of conservative Christianity among white evangelicals. But we should note that not all evangelical Christians are white, not all are conservative, and not all conservative Christians are evangelicals. Today, we're mainly focused on conservative white evangelical Christians. And Sarah, for those who may not know, what is evangelical Christianity?
Yeah, I appreciate all those caveats because, you know, it's a term that historians and pollsters and journalists and sociologists argue about a lot. It is admittedly a broad term, but, you know, it generally refers to theologically and often, but not always, politically conservative Protestant Christians. And often when we're talking about evangelical politics, we're often talking about white evangelicals. There's a big difference, as you noted there, when it comes to race in terms of how people vote. But in terms of spiritual and theological beliefs, evangelicals put a lot of emphasis on having a conversion experience, making a decision for Jesus, as it's often put. And that should lead to a personal relationship with God and with Jesus. Reading the Bible is really important to evangelicals, and the Bible is generally taken literally and seen as without having any errors and as the perfect guide for life, although there is a range of views on exactly how to talk about the Bible. And I should say there's a range of views on everything. Evangelicalism is a big umbrella term. It encompasses a lot of subgroups and, you know, a range of perspectives and beliefs and practices. So there are probably exceptions to just about anything, I should say. But it's a useful term for talking about a group of people, particularly in America, that tend to vote together in large numbers and share a subculture in many ways. The other thing I'll say is that evangelicals really emphasize sharing their faith, spreading their faith to other people. And they often that includes a political project as well.
Well, how have their religious beliefs shaped their political ones?
Well, again, I want to be clear that political beliefs are very different along racial lines. But when we're talking about white evangelicals, they overwhelmingly vote for Republicans. That hasn't always been true to the extent that it is today. And I want to say I'm not a historian. I quote some in my book, of course. But historically, evangelical politics haven't always looked the way they do now. Evangelicalism traces its history back pretty far. You could go back to the Protestant Reformation 500 years ago, or to religious movements more recently that grew out of Protestantism. And, you know, there were evangelicals who were involved in earlier political movements like the temperance movement and the anti-slavery movement, as well as evangelicals who supported slavery, we should say. But most historians would trace the rise of the Christian right in its current iteration to around the beginning of the Reagan era, the late 70s, early 80s, when we saw the founding of groups like the Moral Majority by the late Reverend Jerry Falwell. They started mobilizing white Christians as a political force, and they were reacting to a variety of issues, including the sexual revolution, increasing secularization, and historians like Randall Balmer have argued that the integration of public schools a decade or two before that helped give rise to the alliance, particularly between Southern white evangelicals who were angry at IRS rules requiring them to integrate their schools in order to keep their tax-exempt status. But, you know, abortion is an issue we think about a lot. It really was not an evangelical issue until about this time, the late 70s, early 80s. But today, white evangelicals are the religious group that expressed the most opposition to abortion and have become the most aligned with the Republican Party.
Itad, as we've said, the white evangelical church is shrinking, but how much political power does it have, even as its numbers decline?
If the numbers are declining, you wouldn't know it. Especially because of the issue that Sarah just mentioned, abortion, the repeal of Roe v. Wade, the decision on Dobbs, which was the result of decades and decades of grassroots political fighting, mostly, I think people would agree, from evangelicals and their influence, their leverage on the Republican Party starting in the late 70s. There were other issues, too. That was the main one, and there's simply no way to interpret it except a major victory that took decades of engineering to get justices on the court. Took hundreds of millions of dollars of money, political organization, and concerted effort from evangelicals. So even if the numbers are shrinking, you know, it's okay if numbers shrink, if more and more of the people in the flock are politically engaged and care about presidential elections and care about the court and care about the issues and march, you know, when the march comes up. So I use just the term of abortion because it's the easiest one to wrap your head around. If the numbers are shrinking, the influence is not.
Angela, as we said earlier, not all evangelical Christians are white. In fact, 41% of Black Christians identify as evangelical, even more than their white counterparts. That's according to Public Religion Research Institute. And Latino Americans are the fastest growing segment of evangelicals in the U.S. And we'll talk a bit more about how those demographics are changing in the church later. But why is so much of the political conversation centered on white evangelicals? Evangelicals?
Money and power. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're starting to see too, as Todd notes, you're not noticing the decrease of political power, even though myself as a pastor, we are seeing the widespread exodus of folks from the pews. We're seeing a widespread, you know, lack of understanding the gospel story of people wanting to follow Jesus. We're seeing so many signs of a decline of religiosity in this country. And I'll never forget when I was beginning my research after the 2016 election and spent most of 2018 traveling around the country speaking to folks about this phenomenon of Trumpism and Christianity. I was told over and over again that what folks expect to see happen is that if people are asked to determine between their commitment to Jesus' gospel and their political bona fides and their political power, Jesus is going to lose out. And so I think we're starting to see that, where you're seeing people leaving churches, where you're seeing a lack of allegiance to all of the biblical truth, to the heart of, you know, Jesus' call to charity, Jesus' call to care for the poor. We certainly don't hear that from Trump. And so what you're seeing is more of a cohesion around a set of political beliefs than around a religion. And Christianity in this country, when most people think of what does it mean to be a Christian, people think much more of political beliefs at this time than they do of what's in the gospel. And so Black evangelicals certainly lose out on that conversation, because that's not true, as you've noted, for Black evangelicals. But we hear again and again the story of white evangelicals because of money and power. And I also think there's a phenomenon, you know, as someone who used to be a journalist and then went to seminary, became a pastor, there is a phenomenon in national media of wanting to sort of look at religion as a spectacle and look at religion of let's find the wackiest story we can find, rather than really delving into what's happening in communities and families, particularly in rural parts of this country and particularly in the Midwest.
Coming up, how decades of political activism among white evangelical Christians helped Trump win in 2016 and could help him in November. We'll be right back.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
Every time you drive your car, have a package delivered, or get on a plane, you're polluting the climate. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Nature is powerful. Why don't we use it to our advantage?
Meet the people working on cleaner ways to get around on Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR. Transportation Climate Solutions on Here and Now Anytime, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, I hear you have a birthday coming up. Yeah, you. If you're listening to this, that means you have a birthday coming up eventually. And here at Life Kit, we want it to be a special one.
Magic can happen, and good luck can happen, and serendipity can happen if we're open to it.
How to have a good birthday, even if you're not a birthday person. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
Instead of scrolling mindlessly, engage mindfully with the NPR app. With a mix of on-demand news, stories from this station, and your favorite podcast, you can relax without shutting off your brain. Download the NPR app today.
Let's get back into the conversation with this message from Jana, who identifies as Christian. She writes, "I'm concerned that we as a nation founded on the separation of church and state are not confronting the rise of extreme Christian supremacists who seek to establish a repressive theocracy here in the United States. We need to be aware of the threat of violence and repression dressed up in the robes of Christianity. Trump is not a savior. He is a false god."
And that really brings me to a question about Christian nationalism. The quality of politics on the right among evangelicals has changed, Sarah, from, I think, a place where you were describing as evangelicals rallying around issues to sort of a new trend in the center of our politics, which is Christian nationalism. Help us define the term so that we can parse these things. What exactly is Christian nationalism? People are hearing a lot more about it.
Well, I would actually push back on that just a little bit.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I show in my book is that this isn't entirely new, that there's a long history of a rhetoric in evangelical circles, in the Christian school textbooks that I went and bought used online and quoted from in my book that I had in my own Christian school, and that millions of Christian, you know, evangelical homeschoolers and Christian school kids grew up reading. That talks about America as this specially ordained Christian nation set apart by God, almost like a new Israel in, you know, the new world. This kind of metaphor is very powerful in evangelicalism, and it's been perpetuated in a lot of textbooks and also books by people like David Barber Martin, who is a historian who's been debunked by a lot of mainstream historians for promoting these kind of Christian nationalist ideas. It is like evangelicalism, though. Christian nationalism is a term that's disputed somewhat. And it, I think what's different today is we're seeing people openly in elected office in some cases identifying themselves as Christian nationalists quite proudly. Now, I don't think it's a mainstream view in American evangelicalism, but it's, a rising and more powerful and more explicit view. But, you know, there's some good survey data out there from groups like the Public Religion Research Institute asking people questions like, do you agree with a statement that America should be a Christian nation or that being a Christian is an important part of being an American? And I think generally when we're talking about Christian nationalism, we're talking about this idea, not just that, you know, you can practice your faith in America, but that Christianity is sort of built into American democracy. Christianity should be promoted by the government and laws should be based on Christianity. That's how I and I think other scholars would generally describe Christian nationalism. Although, again, it's a term that's somewhat contentious.
Well, Angela, in 2016, you traveled the country talking to conservative Christians for your book, Red State Christians. It came out in 2019. Then in 2022, you published an updated version of the book. 3 years isn't that long, but between those years, we experienced a global pandemic. The Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, a presidential election, and an attempted insurrection also happened. What did you feel needed updating on this topic?
Yeah, so I spent those 3 years pastoring a rural congregation here in Minnesota, but living in Southwest Minneapolis. So I was very much entrenched kind of with one foot in each political world and two neighborhoods that were very different politically. And so I also live here in Minneapolis, just 6 miles from where George Floyd was murdered. And the major update that I wanted to make in my book is that when I had spoken to groups prior to all of those happenings, I was very clear to tell groups, Jesus is not American. And that sounds like such an obvious statement. But when I would say it, people would kind of look at each other and realize, in the sense, we American Christians, especially white American Christians, had sort of thought of Jesus as an American. And that's what Trump is doing when he's holding up the Bible. He's laying claim that this religion and that Jesus is particularly for white American Christians. When I did the update, what I wanted to say is not only is Jesus not American, but we really need to recognize that Jesus is not white. And seeing that, I wanted to really make more clear in a way that I really wasn't courageous enough to do the first time, that so much of this movement is about the privileging of white Christians. And to make clear that this is something that is happening in spaces across America and across Christianity, and not only in ultra-conservative churches, but that so many of us in our communities have taken under this kind of religion that really has nothing to do with the Jesus of the Bible.
You said you weren't courageous enough to write about this the first time. What gave you pause?
Yeah, I mean, it really was, you know, walking through a lot of the aftermath of George Floyd, but also COVID, you know, and within my own family, my brother-in-law died at age 42 of COVID after a very long hospitalization. And our family at the time was very torn apart politically. And Trumpism just made that entire experience so much more painful because there was the denialism about COVID. There was the suspicion about the vaccine. There was so much injection of political ideology and hatred and anger in the midst of, and I know this was not just my family, in the midst of national grieving. And so I think what we're seeing is this immense experience of suffering and pain, and also the upheaval for white Christians to have to reckon with, again, the extent to which racism is a powerful force in this country. And you're seeing that come out in an experience of hatred and violence instead of, and I think pastors have been culpable in this, that pastors have not been willing to engage in repentance and engage in saying, hey, we've been wrong for a long time, and here's what we can do to make things better. Instead, there's been a re-entrenchment of refusing to let go of the lies that white Christians have been telling ourselves for a long time.
Ms. Sarah, you were raised in a conservative white evangelical household in the 1980s and 90s. Now you're a reporter covering those same communities years after you left. What has it been like returning to those spaces as an adult and journalist trying to make sense of them.
You know, I wrote the book because of this unexpected and sometimes uncomfortable intersection of my personal and professional life. I had had my own, you know, complicated and pretty private relationship with my childhood faith, which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to if they grew up, especially with a very strict, very sort of confined view of the world. Most people, when you grow up, have to kind of go, okay, well, who am I and what do I think about all of this and what parts do I want to keep and not keep or transform in some way? And, you know, I tried to keep that out of my work because that's what we do as journalists. But then in 2016, I was hired to cover the campaign. I was assigned to the Republican primary. And very quickly, evangelicals became such a huge part of the story. You know, they're a huge part of the electorate. They're a big part of the Republican base. And particularly with Donald Trump rising in that campaign and in the primary, there were so many questions swirling around whether or not evangelicals would support and accept him. And, you know, I was thinking back about my own childhood many years before. I remembered what it was like to grow up in the 1990s, you know, when Bill Clinton was being criticized for his moral character by evangelical leaders. And I remembered all the debates around abortion, for example. And so many of these themes were coming back, but in very different ways in that campaign. And then, you know, I was doing a story after the Access Hollywood video was released just before the election, and I was talking to some white evangelical women who were feeling a lot of angst about the alignment of their movement with Trump. And, you know, one of them used this word ex-evangelical to describe the way she felt, you know, and I just started paying attention to that term and realizing there was a really interesting dialogue happening, a lot of it online, a lot of it in podcasts, about people who, like me, for a whole bunch of reasons, were rethinking their faith. And I just became fascinated with that discourse, which wasn't just about Trump, but it was really, I think, catalyzed by the moment that I think Angela was just talking about, where a lot of people had to reflect on what their faith meant to them and what these labels even mean to them.
Todd, there was some news recently about the former president's stance on abortion.
That will be very important to evangelicals and is resonating already today. Donald Trump has spent the campaign bragging about his number one domestic achievement, which is overturning Roe v. Wade. Just today, he made a video saying that he is not for a national abortion ban, that he thinks it should be left up to the states. And he really was quite honest in that statement by saying, I'm paraphrasing now, life was important, but so is winning elections. It's the logic of a transactional politician, which is what politicians do. But there is a lot of negative reaction among the pro-life, largely evangelical community. We're going to have to look forward to see just how dissatisfied they are. I have every expectation they would stay with Trump, but a lot of them are not happy that Trump has backed away from a national abortion ban. We'll have to see where he is as the campaign goes forward. Sarah, getting back to your own experience, though, you know, when you were talking about growing up with an evangelical education, it just made me wonder, from your experience and what you saw growing up with that infrastructure, I'm sure watching the media and also getting your evangelical education, how much of that infrastructure is important today in keeping evangelicals active politically and active, in this case, in the Republican Party?
Well, if anything, it's just bigger today, and it's sort of become subsumed by larger conservative media. I mean, I think I've noticed sometimes on Fox News segments seem to presume that just about everybody watching is a Christian, which may be a fair assumption for the viewership. But, you know, when I was growing up, there was Christian broadcasting, Christian TV, radio, books, magazines. I talk about Focus on the Family, which was and is a hugely influential organization based in Colorado that, you know, started out really primarily focused on marriage and family counseling and advice, and has branched out and has several spinoff groups that are very politically active in primarily conservative and Republican politics. And all of that is still there. But today, you know, like the entire media ecosystem has expanded across the board. This isn't just true for conservative media, but I think today there's just a vast amount of not just Christian publishing, but podcasts, YouTube. I mean, as there is, again, for other perspectives as well. I think, though, that the internet has also made it harder for people to be in a bubble to the degree that I was, you know. I mean, unless, I guess if you're growing up in a home where access to the internet is strictly controlled, then maybe. But I think one of the things that I have noticed about the sort of ex-evangelical hashtag and dialogue and the dialogue around terms like deconstruction is that a lot of these conversations about rethinking one's religious and sometimes political beliefs are happening in online spaces. So while the internet has occasioned, you know, a huge expansion of media options, including conservative media, it also means there's sort of these micro spaces, niche spaces where people can go and talk about anything and everything. And I think that is a big difference, because if you left a religious community in the, you know, before the internet, it was much harder to sort of find other people who were going through that same journey the way that it is today.
Up next, why are millions leaving the white evangelical church behind? And what does that mean for the future of the faith and their political influence? We'll be right back.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Sarah, look, it's not new for any politician to evoke God in their speeches. God bless America, that's not a groundbreaking remark from a politician, despite our country's separation of church and state. But how is what Trump doing any different?
No, you're right. It's not new, particularly not for Republican politicians. But I think that Trump has managed to persuade white evangelicals that he will particularly fight for them, and also that he can fight for them and achieve their objectives. You know, I remember in the 1990s, and I write about this in the Ex-Evangelicals, I remember hearing people like James Dobson express, who was a prominent evangelical leader, still is today, was the founder of Focus on the Family. But he expressed frustration with the Republican Party for essentially not being conservative enough, not platforming candidates that were sufficiently opposed to abortion rights, for example. But Trump, he has bragged about this to evangelical audiences, he got it done, essentially. He got Roe v. Wade overturned. And you know, I'm thinking about a pastor I talked to in Iowa who's a pastor and a state lawmaker earlier this year who supports Trump. And he said that, you know, Trump's brash demeanor is essentially, I'm paraphrasing here, essentially it's a feature, not a bug. He said that he wanted somebody who was a fighter in the political arena because that's what we need, as he put it.
Angela, that makes me wonder, and I'm especially curious about this from your position as a pastor, to what degree is this seen as a political battle as compared to spiritual warfare? I heard a lot about spiritual warfare when I was coming up in church.
Yes, it's a lot about spiritual warfare. You know, my book, Red State Christians, opens with my visit to a megachurch, Preston Wood, in Dallas, Texas, on 4th of July weekend. And what I noted even back then, I mean, that seems like ancient history now, that was 2018, they showed a video montage during right after the sermon, and they were playing a song called "We'll Never Forget Your Sacrifice." Now, this idea that Jesus' death on the cross was a sacrificial atonement, that Jesus was sacrificed in order to forgive the sins of Christians, what they did is they played that same song, "We'll Never Forget Your Sacrifice," but instead of images of Jesus on the cross, they shared images of American soldiers. And so the evangelical churches have for a long time been laying the groundwork for an understanding that Jesus' sacrifice on the cross is explicitly linked to support of America and explicitly linked towards sacrifice for the quote-unquote greatness of America. Now, what Trump has done uniquely from Republican politicians of the past is that Trump has taken that on with a distinct blend of authoritarianism. The evangelical church is very well set up for authoritarianism. It's very hierarchical. White men are at the top. Fathers are at the top in families. Husbands and fathers are considered to be the final decision makers. And so there was such fertile ground for an authoritarian leader to come in and position himself at the top of that hierarchy and position himself as the direct recipient of Jesus' sacrifice. It's such a twisting and a desecrating of what happened on the cross, because of course Jesus was in fact killed by the empire, instead of Jesus was not, you know, the bearer of the empire. Donald Trump has much more in common with Pontius Pilate than he has with Jesus Christ. But that is the theological groundwork that's been laid, and it's directly linked to Trump as an authoritarian leader, and he has to be seen in that vein and not as a traditional Republican politician.
As we've said, Angela, the white evangelical church is shrinking. What are you hearing about why people are leaving?
You know, I just saw some data the other day that it's been a very gendered leaving, that the majority of folks who are leaving are women. And I think that it's really powerful to have both Sarah and I think we're around the same age. We really grew up in the height of purity culture. And we grew up at this time in Christianity and in American culture where, on one hand, women were beginning to participate in sports, were being told you can do all these different things. And at the same time, there's this deep sense of shame around femininity within Christianity. And I think a lot of women our age, as we've become mothers and as we're raising our own children, are starting to push back on that shame and starting to be able to stand up and say, you know what, I am not ashamed of my voice as a woman. And so I think you're seeing a lot of women leaving, particularly too, again, we cannot ignore the sexual abuse crisis. There's been a lot of press lately coming out of the Southern Baptist Convention and the large-scale cover-up of abuse within the Southern Baptist Convention. The Southern Baptist Convention is the largest evangelical denomination in this country. Many megachurches that have sort of ambiguous names are in fact affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention. So the abuse crisis is a huge part of this, and women leaving and claiming our status as beloved children of God and our belief in a God who does not call for us to be abused.
Sarah, in your interviews with others who've left the white evangelical church, you found that Trump was a big reason. How has Trump shed light on the cracks in the church?
I think it's forced a lot of conversations, again, about what it really means to be evangelical. And it's interesting, you know, there's a lot happening in the evangelical church right now. The decline is not just in evangelicalism, it's across the board with white Christianity. But it's particularly noteworthy for white evangelicals because they have such an outsized impact on American politics. They vote in large numbers and they dominate the Republican Party in many ways. But the people I talked to, many of them felt that their churches had not responded to this moment in the way that they thought they should. And, you know, Angela talked about COVID and about racial justice. Those are also two other issues I heard about a fair amount when I was talking to ex-evangelicals. And so I think there's a real rethinking about what these labels mean. At the same time, though, interestingly, there's evidence that some people are newly identifying as evangelical, particularly white Americans, because they like Donald Trump. So what this label means is shifting.
So, Sarah, in a society that is less religious and more polarized, I just want to understand how evangelicalism is changing as a category.
Sociologists I talk to think it's becoming increasingly a political category. It appears that people are, especially younger people, and as Angela mentioned, women, are less likely to use this word for themselves. Evangelicalism doesn't seem to align with their worldview in many cases. But for people who do feel drawn to the Republican Party as it is today and drawn to Trumpism, again, there's some evidence from pollsters like the Pew Research Center that for some people, they're newly adopting this label. And so, you know, evangelicalism has such a long history and a long tradition that originally had, you know, mostly a spiritual, theological, religious connotation. But I think today it is increasingly associated with a political label. And so that shapes the way that people use it.
And the consequences of that shift?
The concern I've heard, again, in doing research for the book, is that what we're seeing is just a deepening polarization. You know, we see that in across the board in American culture, and I think we're seeing it in churches too. A lot of people I talk to feel this very personally. Many ex-evangelicals find themselves at odds with family members, because it's not just about beliefs. And this is something I really try to get across, that being an evangelical is not just about holding to a set of theological presuppositions. It's also about a culture and a sort of shared community and a shared worldview and language and again, even sort of shared media. And to move away from that can also feel like not just a change in belief, but a change in identity. And I think that creates a lot of pain and a lot of tension points, often in churches and even in families.
Angela, briefly, what do you think the future of white evangelicalism will look like in the next few years?
I think we'll continue to see it becoming more and more of a political label, and I think also a racial label. I saw some data recently on Hispanic evangelicals that looks at also the proportion of Hispanic Americans who would identify as white. And there's, you know, increasing breakdowns between folks who are recent immigrants or people who have been living in the United States for a longer amount of time. I had a chapter in my book on Latino evangelicals that identified some of these issues. So I think the future is a movement away from the church, and those churches who remain must entrench ourselves in the real teachings of Jesus and remain faithful.
That's Angela Danker. She's an author and Lutheran pastor. Her forthcoming book is called Disciples of White Jesus, The Radicalization of American Boyhood. Also with us, Sarah McCammon, a political correspondent for NPR. Her new book is called The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. And of course, thanks to Todd Swillick for being with us for this hour of If You Can Keep It. It's our weekly examination of the issues and stakes of the 2024 election cycle. And if you haven't heard yet, we just launched 1A Plus. When you join 1A Plus, you get to listen to our show sponsor-free, and you're supporting our work. Go to plus.npr.org/the1A to find out more. Today's producer was Haley Blassingame. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt, because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.